You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
The nation's financial crisis has forced many magazines to downsize and even to cease publishing, but that doesn't mean you can't still find quite a bit of excellent magazine writing, as evidenced by the 2008 edition of the Best American Magazine Writing. I'm joined now by two of its contributors, Vanessa Grigoriadis and Jean Marie Laskus, to speak about the book, which is published by Columbia University Press. Hello, and I mangled probably both of your names.
No, you did great.
Oh, I'm so
pleased. You got it the second time on mine. So.
In the introduction, Jacob Weisberg, the editor-in-chief of Slate magazine, wonders about the uncertain future of the magazine medium. The rise of the Internet has led to a serious decrease in magazine ad revenues, and many publications have been forced to trim their staffs. What do you think magazines will have to do to survive the digital age? I'll begin with you, Vanessa.
Well, if I knew the answer to that question, I would not just be a lowly magazine writer. But I think that there's still a place for the kind of writing that both I and Jean Marie do, which is long-form, highly narrative, character-driven nonfiction. Of something like 6 to 10 pages, where it's really a story first and foremost. And I think that those things remain extremely hard to read on the Internet. At least for me, I know that I have to print out most of those stories. I get about 1,000 words in, and my eyes start to glaze over, no matter how good the writer is.
But Jacob Weisberg writes, not many readers have an hour for an article that took 3 months to write. So is part of the problem diminishing attention spans? Jean Marie, what do you say? You teach students who you probably are seeing diminishing attention spans from.
Oh, yes. But I will say, you know, this same discussion has been going on really since I got into this whole racket in the 90s, when everyone was really, you know, upset that there was, you know, the market for this sort of long-form narrative was diminishing. And, you know, Sunday supplements were dying right and left in newspapers. And, you know, general interest magazines were sort of going by the wayside, and the marketplace the marketplace for our kind of work got smaller and smaller, and indeed it continues to shrink. However, I don't think it's getting replaced by anything that the Internet can offer. I would agree with Vanessa on that. You're not going to sit down and read that kind of story on the Internet.
So what do you tell the students in your creative writing classes at the University of Pittsburgh who might be interested in writing for magazines? Go ahead.
I tell them, let's not talk about the marketplace, please. Let's talk about writing stories. Because no matter what you're going to do, you're going to have to write a good story. And let's not drive it by the marketplace, or else you'll just be writing recipes and celebrity, you know, sort of fashion pieces. That's what the marketplace will ask you for.
Well, what actually struck me was that, except in a few instances, most of the magazines that are represented in this book are the big ones, the ones we would expect. The New Yorker, The Atlantic, Vanity Fair, New York, which, Vanessa, your article appeared in, GQ, which your article, Jean Marie, appeared in, the kinds of magazines that actually have the money to encourage this sort of thing. Because these pieces take a lot of research, don't they? They take a lot of time. Would it be possible to publish these elsewhere? For example, in newspaper? Vanessa, would your article have been able to appear in a newspaper?
I don't think my article would have appeared because of the tone and the length of it in a newspaper. But if you look at the actual, you know, expenses associated with this piece that I wrote that was essentially about Gawker.com and the folks that work there and the way that they were all trying to snooker print journalists into feeling really depressed about their state in life, which ends up being very prescient. The expenses were fairly minimal, and I'm sure Jean Marie's piece, which was about working in a coal mine, in a way, probably were not that high as well. I mean, there's lots of pieces that are written that don't require being flown all over the world and wining and dining a lot of sources. But I think the issue is just that you need a structure of editors who are willing to commit to several rewrites of the piece, to talking through some of the ideas with you. I mean, some of these pieces end up being quite collaborative because they're very complicated. And certainly newspapers do not have that kind of structure.
Do you think, was one of your impulses in writing about Gawker.com a kind of revenge, writing about the competition that you say Gawker works because it's about the anxiety and rage of New York's creative underclass?
Yeah, I mean, I think it was a little bit for me. I mean, essentially, you know, I think maybe it was like 2003, I went to a party and somebody said, oh, look at this little woman over here. She writes this blog called Gawker. And, you know, my question was, what's Gawker and what's a blog? I mean, and look at us now. And certainly I spent, you know, a lot of the last 5 years looking at blogs, and it really changed my experience as a journalist, because I used to go out, talk to people, maybe look for little interesting stories in newspapers, versus reading blogs online, which really is just reprocessed information that, as a journalist, you really can't do that much with it unless you just want to get on board with it and make everything you write be something that relates to that area. So I think blogs have contributed in that kind of deeper way to stymieing a lot of really interesting journalism, because they just really narrow the discourse in a way, the news discourse of the day.
Well, you write that Gawker's somewhat snide style has become the de facto voice for many blogs today. Why do you think Gawker's insult culture has proved so popular?
I think it has something to do with the anonymity of the internet medium. You know, they've known for a long time that people will say and do things over the internet that they wouldn't in person, and some people find that quite liberating. And I do think that there's a lot of people who read sites like Gawker who are frustrated artists of one sort or another, and they take a lot of pleasure in the schadenfreude. I just think it's, for me, I really wanted to unpack why I even got caught up in something like that, because really my career was fine. There was no reason for me to want to, you know, be somehow part of that. And yet I did get somewhat wrapped up in it, just in terms of it became one of my main, you know, sources of news.
Well, were you worried at all about opening yourself up to a Gawker backlash against you? Because they can get rather nasty.
I mean, I think I didn't really think about that while the piece was going on, and then maybe a day or two before it closed, I was talking to a friend of mine, and he said, I cannot believe you're doing this. I mean, whenever there's a slow news day, they're going to be like, where's that Greek girl? Let's take her out. Let's, you know, let's flog her one more time. And I got extremely nervous. And in the end, you know, there was really very little backlash from Gawker. I got kind of beat up by Page Six, which I had, in a very offhand way, said was not quite the Page Six that we were all used to reading 10 years ago, which infuriated them. But, you know, there, I don't know. I mean, maybe there's something to take from that if you really spend some time going after the bullies and you really explain to the bullies why what they're doing is unconscionable, maybe that makes them retreat a little bit.
Well, in March, they said that you were a deceptively cute profile writer whose personal charm masks an incisive and ferocious journalist. I'm talking with Vanessa Grigoriadis, I'm so sorry, and also Jean Marie Laskus, two of the contributors to the Best America magazine, writing 2008, compiled by the American Society of Magazine Editors and published by Columbia University Press. Also in the book are people like Kurt Anderson, Christopher Hitchens, Walter Kern, William Langerwisch, Jean Mayer, George Packer, Matt Taibbi, Matthew Scully. Let's talk a bit about the miners that you profiled in your article, Jean Marie. Southern Ohio, would this have been just the same if you had profiled miners in West Virginia or some of the other coal mining areas?
Oh, sure. A coal miner is a coal miner, at least in America. These guys were, I found the one coal mine that would let me in. It's a very, very, very secretive little world. And these guys were just, you know, completely welcoming. So I had complete access for, like a four-month period of time until I felt I had enough.
Well, why are they secretive? Are they afraid that you might see something that they don't want you to see?
Sure. Well, you know, they're just the only time you ever hear anything about a coal mine is bad news. You know, it's an explosion or it's some hideous accident. And so the coal companies don't want, you know, they have nothing to gain from letting you in to come look around. So I had to sort of fight against that. And I was trying to write the other story, you know, that's all we ever hear about coal miners is when something bad happens, is like what happens the rest of the time when we're not hearing about them. You know, you sort of think this is this antiquated industry that doesn't, this sort of cute maybe that, you know, used to be, but in fact it's where we get our electricity. So it's vibrant.
Well, in the beginning of your article, you quote a newscaster who was reporting during one of last year's accidents saying, "Why do we need coal anyway?"
Yeah, she said, why do we even have coal mines? That actually was the reason that got me interested in the story. Because I did, you know, I live in western Pennsylvania where there are coal mines everywhere. I don't know a single coal miner. I'm thinking, you know, who are these people? And why do they go under and do this dangerous work? It's such a naive question. But in fact, we're completely out of touch with this energy source, completely out of touch. When in fact, it's thriving now.
Now, the mine gave you access. What about the miners? Were you able to gain the trust of the miners?
Oh, sure. I think, well, you know, all these kinds of stories take an awful lot of time. And you go in and you basically stand, you know, sit there and stare for a while until someone agrees to talk to you. It's not something that, you know, you become part of the culture. It's a really kind of the classic immersion story. And you wait long enough, and usually folks like that will feel sorry enough for you that they'll start talking to you.
Do they feel that they're in an endangered industry?
No. They know they're riding high. That, you know, I've been doing a lot of energy-type stories like this. Also, I did a lengthy piece about the Alaska pipeline, and I was up in the oil fields on the North Slope, and, you know, they're all just, you know, whistling. This is the heyday for them.
Well, you've written about energy things. Vanessa, you've covered a wide range of topics as a magazine writer. Karl Lagerfeld, eco-terrorism, Britney Spears. Could you have written those pieces for a newspaper or an online magazine?
I think, you know, a lot of the things that I'm interested in write about are, you know, I don't know about the eco-terrorism, but they're fairly mainstream, certainly Britney Spears. Everybody likes to put their two cents in about that. I think it's really just a question of length and time. Things can be written about, but they can just be, you know, thought about for a day and then thrown into a blog or presented in a more cleaned up version in a newspaper versus, you know, something like the Britney Spears story. Okay, maybe I only spent 6 weeks, let's say, on that, but every day in 6 weeks I was, you know, in Los Angeles making some sort of contact with somebody in Britney's realm. And
is there enough about Britney Spears to actually require you to devote 6 weeks to her?
Well, I mean, at that time, she was, you know, kind of running around Los Angeles with about 100 paparazzi cars behind her, and she was wearing those wigs and tossing off all sorts of, as we now know, you know, mentally deranged, you know, statements. So she had shut down her world to the point where she had no manager, no publicist, no contact with a record company. I mean, it was a pretty dramatic case of a star in complete free fall. So there were actually a lot of kind of underbelly characters that she had gotten herself associated with that I was able to make contact with.
Were you surprised by the success of the new album?
I was extremely surprised by that, actually, because I can't believe that, you know, 10 months ago, this woman was hospitalized twice, you know, against her will, and yet now she's presenting herself as just exactly the same blonde teeny bopper that she always was, and somehow people seem to want her back. I mean, I guess you have to say that goes for the American spirit of second chances there.
Jean Marie, what about your article on the coal mines? Would a newspaper have given you that much space or that much time to research your topic?
No. And that's, I think, the really big difference, whether it's a Britney Spears story or a coal miner story or any of these. It's almost like the topic is irrelevant. It's the, you know, what newspapers do and what magazines do have always been dramatically different. I mean, you know, no, you're not going to go to a newspaper you're going to go there for news of Britney Spears or news of a coal mining accident. The kind of work that a magazine can do, especially the long form narrative, is you know, sit there and ponder. And right now, that it's becoming something of a luxury to have 4 months to sit and think about coal or think about oil, or you know, and not simply report the news on these matters, but to kind of create, you know, it's almost like we're starting to be like fiction writers, you know. The work that we do is the kind of stuff you take and sit and a reader takes and sits and reads and sort of savors, and that's becoming, I do think that's becoming something of a sad, quaint, I don't know, something that we're ready to dispose of. I don't want to sound pessimistic, but the world is changing dramatically.
Recently, the Bush White House approved a new regulation that will make it easier for coal mining companies to dump rock and dirt from mountaintop mining operations into nearby streams and valleys. Would the coal miners support that kind of thing, or is it just the companies that they work for?
I don't think the coal miners themselves, the people I write about, the people who are daily, you know, doing the work, think much about any of this, frankly.
Well, they do live in the area, don't they? And wouldn't it be the water, the streams that go by their homes?
Yes, if you could prove it to them. I don't want to speak for them, but I think their sense of the environmental concerns or that this is all the blown up stuff from you know, sort of Washington. This is not true to their lives. There is not this kind of the workers and of the even the folks in the town. This concern of the environment. There just isn't.
So they have a negative feeling about all this talk about developing green energy?
I think they're wary of it. I think they think it's you know, they understand coal. They understand that this is something that works and that it has always worked. And their fathers and grandfathers and great grandfathers were coal miners. So what's the problem? You know, I mean, it's a matter of, you know, it's a matter of their jobs. And this is also an industry that did die out for quite some time and came back in, especially in the eastern United States, that came back in the last decade. So they're not willing to let it go so quickly.
Well, during the campaign, both candidates talked about clean coals. They must have made them feel good.
Well, because of all the new technology, that's why it came back, because they were able to burn it more without you know, such a disaster on the atmosphere. But, you know, talk to an environmentalist about that, and they'll tell you that's really not so believable. So, I mean, the jury's not out on that clean coal thing at all.
Do the two of you read the greats of the past, the magazine writers of the past, and would a collection of Joseph Mitchell's essays be in your bookcase, for example?
Yeah, I do have a Joseph Mitchell collection. I think probably everybody does. I'm not actually as huge of a fan of Joseph Mitchell as a lot of other people.
I'm just using him as an example.
I think that, yes. I mean, you know, this is something that I have thought a lot about in terms of young journalists, and there's been a lot of talk about how there aren't quite as many or of the same quality young kind of narrative nonfiction journalists out there. And what I always say is it's because the training really isn't there. And now, you know, nobody held my hand, but I started working at New York Magazine about 12 years ago when Kurt Anderson was the editor. And, you know, I was one of the assistants. I answered the phones, and part of my job was anytime somebody who was somehow a friend of the magazine called and wanted an article, I would have to go to the library, get the article, Xerox the article, and send it to them. And that meant that I, who had not read a lot of great magazine writing, suddenly had in my palm, you know, a lot of the amazing writing that was done at New York Magazine in the 70s and 80s. And I of course, made a copy for myself, and I read it as I was sitting there answering those phones. And, you know, I don't want to misspeak, but I don't think New York Magazine has a library anymore. It certainly is difficult to find the hard copies of a lot of different magazines. That is an enormous problem, because unless you have read and really been steeped in at least the house voice of one magazine, let's say, it's very hard to develop your own voice, because, you know, writing is imitation first and foremost. So so that was my training, really.
And Jane Marie, you teach writing. Do you teach magazine writing?
You know, it's interesting. We're just in the process of talking about what to do with our journalism program, which is kind of this arm of our English department, and trying to lead people into newspaper careers. And we're talking about, well, how relevant is that? I teach in what we call now, you know, creative nonfiction. That's the new buzz term for in academic circles for what we do as narrative long form journalists. But I will tell you the trend by far for students is memoir. Everyone wants to write about their lives. And my push always is, you know, you are 18 years old or 19 years old, and, you know, you might want to put that off, that memoir, and go out and, you know, experience a bit of the world. That's becoming such a fight to get students to be curious, and I don't know what that's about.
Well, they
want to go out and experience something to write about.
They might want to get a copy of my brother's book, the book he edited, The Art of the Personal Essay, which is not just about memoir, but it's about that sort of thinking, just thinking aloud as an essayist. It's not journalism, but it's something else. But I suspect that
Absolutely.
Memoir is because of the success of memoir, or is it because blogs are, in a way, a form of memoir?
I think everybody's life is fascinating now that we've got blogs, or that we now have given license to, you know, whatever you just did this morning is somehow sort of relevant to record. And, you know, yeah, it is in some ways, but what then do you go do with that material? It's that next step that happens. You know, blogging is almost like taking notes, and it's taking notes in your journal that you happen to be sharing now with, you know, the world. What then to do with that material? That next step, I don't find folks as quite as interested in as they once were.
I've been talking with Jean Marie Laskus and Vanessa Grigoriadis, two of the contributors, along with the likes of Matt Taibbi, Matthew Scully, George Packer, Jane Mayer, Caitlin Flanagan, Kurt Anderson, Christopher Hitchens, Walter Kern, in the latest edition of Best American Magazine Writing, the 2008 edition, published by Columbia University Press. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you.
Pleasure.